HPPodCraft.com.
Just like April showers bring May flowers, your April comments create May content. Nailed it.
Got it. Welcome to the show where you do the heavy lifting.
Yes.
And we just kind of ride on your coattails.
Love it.
It's the HP Podcraft comment show for May, here exclusively on Patreon. Thank you for listening and supporting our show.
We need your support to keep going. Life is very difficult without friends, and we're very glad to have you as ours. You know what else is difficult? Rhyming something with comments, I discovered just now. There really isn't a good rhyme for comments. So no. We may end up changing this to the remarks show just to help me with my rhyming schemes.
So let's begin with episode 590, Jerry Jarvis's wig. Richard Horseman writes, love this. I was immediately reminded of Hell Toupee, the Amazing Stories episode about a possessed toupee that makes its wearer do crimes. I hadn't thought of that in decades, and now I want to go and watch it again.
I kind of remember that. I didn't know that it was Hell Toupee was the name of it.
Oh, I did. Yeah, I remembered it. Once he said this, I don't know why I didn't think of it, because I loved that episode. I watched it a few times. Longtime hater, another listener called Longtime Hater, says, Chad, what haunted object compelled you to list every example of this trope other than the Treehouse of Horrors, where Homer receives a hair transplant after Snake was executed by the whichever state?
I don't know. I'm crazy, because that's a great one. I guess it's just that, you know, like South Park said, The Simpsons did it. You can just assume that they've done it on that show, but that is such a funny Treehouse of Horror episode. They shoot the hair to death while it's trying to escape. That's my favorite part of it. Like, it almost gets out the window and then it doesn't, but then it gets up again and they keep shooting it, and then Wiggum says, now that was a bad hair day, and they all laugh. And it's got one, it's almost like this show when we call out certain things, because Marge goes, why are we all laughing? Two people died. And then she goes, well, no, wait a minute, I get it. And then she starts laughing too. It's so great.
Ben A. wrote, what a wonderfully bizarre story. Thank you all, especially Jamie, for bringing it to our attention. Chad, you read my mind about the wig being a Friday the 13th cursed object. The curse you suggested sounded so much like what would have appeared on the show. Let's not forget that was a series that involved cursed gloves that melted its owner's hands, many cursed jewels activated by blood, a harrowing cursed trepanator, and even a cursed pool cue. If you want a campy bonus episode at some point, I'd recommend an episode of Friday the 13th.
I would love to, but they're not available for streaming. Amazon has them listed, but it says not available at this time. So hopefully in the future, I'll be able to stream them through Amazon Prime or rent them. But I would love to watch those.
Oh, yeah. I love that show.
The one I can only ever remember is the haunted tattoo gun, where the guy would tattoo a scorpion on somebody's arm and then it would come to life and kill them for whatever reason. But the trepanator, I didn't know what that was. I had to look it up.
Yeah.
I assume it's the device you use to punch a hole in a person's head, you know, like trepanning. I think that is what it is. But when you Google trepanator, what kept coming up was a 1992 straight-to-video movie called Trepanator, which is the French ripoff of Reanimator.
What?
It really is. The poster looks exactly the same. The synopsis of it is Dr. Herbert East is working in his uncle's clinic and experimenting with brain transplants. So it really is. It's a B-movie version of Reanimator called Trepanator.
I mean, that would be kind of a C-movie.
It's a Wii movie. Because it's French, you see.
Ah, oui.
David Gutierrez writes, Chad, I loved your singing. Very Bowie-esque. And thank you. High praise. Although I think he's talking about that very first Bowie album from 67. You know that one? Mm. With Rubber Band on it, like when he hadn't found his Bowie-ness yet. Yeah. I bought that actually at a record store back when the record store owners would sneer at you. The guy at Penny Lane was like, are you sure you want to buy that? Because he thought, I didn't know what I was doing. It just said David Bowie on it. I know what this is. It came out the same day as Sgt. Pepper's in 67.
Oh, wow.
He did not know what he was doing yet. And in fact, that album is, he's very much doing an imitation of Anthony Newley, who is an actor singer in England. If you watch any videos of Anthony Newley, you'll be surprised to find that Bowie himself stole his act, or at least the way he sings. But he hadn't really gotten dialed in the Spiders from Mars-esqueness of his stuff yet, so they're really goofy pop songs. Anyway, that was a little bit of a diversion. Matthew Alderman writes, did Bin He's a whole story to himself, essentially the inventor of the one-man show and something close to an 18th century Victor Borga Weird Al.
Mm.
You know what? I'm not sure if even that's entirely true. I think he's a little bit more like a David Bowie. Matthew actually shared an article about him, which I read. I'll put it in the show notes.
Mm-hmm.
But it's called How the First Ever Pop Star Blazed a Trail of Innovation. Didbin was huge.
Mm.
The opening paragraph says, think of an era-defining, wildly popular pop star. Are you picturing David Bowie? Prince, Elton John, maybe Taylor Swift or Adele, the solo singer-songwriter whose persona is as well-known as their music and lyrics, cornerstone of popular music, yet none of those names achieved anything like the domination of Britain's first popular music star, Charles Dibdin. If the name isn't familiar, that's probably because he died in 1814, although you might recognize the tune of one of his many nautical songs, Tom Bowling. This goes on to say he was the most dominant singer-songwriter Britain's ever had. I'll link out to the article. I highly, highly recommend folks check it out. He was famous in his lifetime, and then for about 60, 70 years after death, his songs were still popular, but eventually that kind of fame does die too. But he kind of created the first one-man shows. He did stand-up comedy. He was like the first guy to sell his sheet music so that his legend could grow. He did merchandise at his shows. He was the first do that. And a lot of it had to do with he was a genius and was a great songwriter as well as performer, but he was very fussy about things and people didn't like working with him.
Mm-hmm.
So he was like, well, how can I do this all myself? And that whole tradition of the one person juggernaut was born with this guy. So he really is the model for all pop stars to come after. And we were sort of making fun of it like it was this obscure thing, but it's not. He was a huge celebrity.
I did not know any of that. I'll have to read that article myself. Zane Graves writes, I need to see this entire story done as a sketch on RuPaul's Drag Race. I guess because of wigs, but also RuPaul's Drag Race does dip its toe into horror/comedy.
Yeah.
Every so often. They have sketches where I think they did a Thelma and Louise parody where they were zombies.
Well, get on the phone to your people and see if they can make this happen.
I'll do what I can. Steve writes, I want to know how the wig got all of its evil powers. Was Jarvis such an appalling person, or do the rich and powerful just exude crime the way a gardener sweats? Or perhaps the ridicule to which all wearers were exposed has turned the wig and have made it the enemy of mankind.
I kind of thought that not learning why the wig was cursed is what made it a true weird tale. You wouldn't want to know it was a serial killer's wig, or they hint at a deal with the devil, which I think is likely what it is. And when a deal with the devil is made in one of these stories, it generally is just hinted at. Nobody ever depicts the scene.
Yeah. Rafe Ball writes, our old friend August Derleth wrote a haunted wig story, A Wig for Miss DeVore, in Weird Tales Bay, 1943, which was adapted into an episode of Boris Karloff's Thriller series in 1962. And Rafe put links in the comments for those, so if you want to check those out, go look in the comments. The Weird Tales story is pretty ho-hum, but the synopsis for the adaptation sounds like a definite improvement and is described on the Big Gay Horror Fan website as one of the gayest hours of horror ever.
Go on. I'm going to have to check out the Big Gay Horror Fan website.
That sounds awesome.
Yeah.
Ethan Cordry writes, actually, ovicide in this context means sheep murderer, not egg murderer. As in the sheep murdering that he'd just been dreaming about, though technically the word can also mean egg murderer, so you're not exactly wrong.
Good to be corrected. I did say it with a special self-congratulatory cleverness that I knew that ovicide meant egg murder, but I guess it also means sheep murder, which is more likely what was going on. So
yes.
Thank you. Eric, speaker in digressions, writes, so I woke up with Dibdin's wig gallery song stuck in my head and did me a Google. Apparently the saying, the wisdom's in the wig, was expected to be recognizable decades later in the U.S. Here's some thrilling commentary on the connection between hair and wisdom in an 1860s Massachusetts newspaper from a much longer piece on the history of beards. Eric's typical morning reading. The beard was the badge of the philosopher, though probably there were wise men without beards. And in aftertimes, when shaving was the fashion set by Alexander the Great, the beard was assumed in such ostentatious proportions by the philosophers that the saying arose, a long beard does not make a philosopher. And when a would-be philosopher was found out, it was said his wisdom stopped at his beard. Just as we say, all the wisdom's in the wig. And that's from the 1860s. So even in America, that was a phrase. To me, the thing I just learned is that Alexander the Great was the one who popularized shaving.
Hmm.
I didn't know that. And also that makes sense why even wizards have those long, long beards, because they're sort of an interpretation of what a philosopher would be presenting himself as.
Yeah, yeah.
The comment ends, anyway, I'm now looking forward to an evil beard story some other time. Well, if we can find one, we'll do it. I'm sure there's plenty.
Brown Jenkin himself writes, throughout my 27 years of living, I believed a cat burglar was legitimately a thief that went around stealing cats from homes. I haven't had a shocker like this since I learned it's a laptop, not a lab-top. L-A-B. Uh-huh. And now I have to try and comprehend this story? This episode was definitely a spoonful.
That's awesome. Thank you for admitting that you thought that. Because why wouldn't you think a cat burglar steals cats?
Mm-hmm.
That seems pretty obvious. Also, I always love that technology is defined by what came before. The fact that we even still call them movies because they didn't used to move. But mm-hmm. a laptop, it's articulated that way because it's the height of accessibility. I mean, you can take that big old tower that you have to use and actually have a computer that's on your lap. That's how small it is. It's commenting about the size of it. Now, if you imagine what a computer is, it's just a laptop. People don't really think of, unless you're getting a gaming computer or something, you're not mm-hmm. going to be thinking about that tower and that it's a big bulky thing. For somebody who's 27, I imagine you might just, it's a laptop. You know, you get your lab work done on that. It makes sense. Yeah. So thank you, Brown Jenkins himself, for cracking open your skull and sharing that with us. Episode 591, The Apparition of Mrs. Veal. Rafe Ball writes, 10 things you didn't know about the afterlife. Number 7 will shock you. Greg Johnson via Facebook added to that, St. Peter hates that one weird trick. Yep, that's what it was. Internet marketing.
Mortal Glare writes, I'm so glad someone is finally getting the history of our great country right. What many don't know, however, was that it was pulled out of the ocean by leprechauns as guided by St. Patrick.
Thank you, Mortal Glare, for hearing that offhanded comment that I said Ireland rose out of the sea all at once. It was couched in the middle of some actual facts, so in the Lovecraftian style, but glad that somebody heard it. Robbie H. writes, Daniel Defoe does like his long titles. It is generally accepted that he wrote a book under a false name of Captain Charles Johnson called, quote, A General History of the Robberies and Murders of the Most Notorious Pirates, spelled with a Y, 1724, which was shortened to A General History of Pirates. He also likes his tongue-in-cheek writing. A General History is one of the first mentions of the Golden Age of Pirates, which you still hear. During that time frame, a Golden Age generally meant the height of the Roman Empire when culture and military tactics were at their height. So to imply that a bunch of drunken barbarians were cut from the same cloth as the Roman Empire may have ruffled some feathers. Funny, it was him being a little scandalous writing that or making a joke, being ironic, and yet that is what we call it even today.
Uh-huh.
Also, A General History was also one of the first mentions of the Jolly Roger.
Peter Larson writes, I love Defoe. He had his fingers in so many literary pies. He kind of created our idea of pirates along with the 1950s Treasure Island. Mm-hmm. And I loved the first 100 or so years of popular printing. They had literally no idea what a printed page should look like, so they tried all sorts of mad things until we ended up with the system that we have today and call normal. Defoe was on the cutting edge of what was going to be news and what was going to be fiction and what was going to be SEO marketing.
Yep.
He is definitely in the highest heaven or the lowest hell, even odds which. Richard Horseman writes, I wonder if it's a coincidence that the names Sherlock and Watson pop up in this, or if it's where Conan Doyle got them from. He did like a good supernatural encounter and was pretty susceptible to hoaxes.
I wonder, too, because there's a mention of an author, Dr. Sherlock, in there, and then I think Watson was the name of the cousin she had to go see.
Yeah.
So both of those names are in there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if he ever spoke about where he pulled them from, but that would be interesting. Mountie of Madness writes, great, that bit of advertising jargon is now lodged in my brain. Thanks, Chad, I guess. At least I will try not to blurt it out next time I see that trope. On Twitter, Clint Page wrote, I learned about two Cthulhus and a Kadaff on this episode. So he took a different meaning away from that.
Good.
Which is nicer.
Our comment show, Dracolades, John Hazard writes, Chad, please watch Life Force and do an episode on it. You will not be sorry. It is nuts. Well, okay, John, we will. This month's bonus episode will be the movie Life Force.
Yeah, a few people asked for that, and so I haven't seen it, so let's do it. For the record, I'm skeptical that I'm going to enjoy this movie. It seems like if I haven't seen it yet, there's probably a reason. I could be wrong.
Yeah.
It is a Toby Hooper, Dan O'Bannon.
I seem to remember it's a little slow, but I haven't watched it in probably 20, 25 years or something like that.
It's brought to you by the people that brought you American Ninja.
There you go.
And Masters of the Universe. And Texas Chainsaw Massacre too. So perhaps I'll like it. We're going to give it a shot. It'll be an entertaining episode nonetheless that I hope folks will tune in for. So our bonus episode this month is going to be Life Force. Tom Krall writes, you haven't watched The Midnight Mass? You guys need to watch it ASAP. It's amazing, and after almost a decade of listening to your takes and opinions, I'm pretty sure you both will love it. Well, it's on the list. You haven't watched it at all, have you?
I haven't seen it, no.
Yeah, it's on Netflix. I was a little burned by the Hill House series, I gotta admit, by the same team. I mean, I really liked it, so that's why it was a burn, because I just didn't like the way it ended. And it's almost worse when it's really awesome for a while and then takes a left turn, which I felt that one did, or it just got a little ponderous. You know, all credit to the filmmakers for engaging me at that level. I understand that, you know, the ending might not have been to everybody's taste. Some people loved it. Anyway, I will give Midnight Mass a chance. A lot of people have said it's great.
Josh Bell writes, I'm really excited about the potential of Golden Age sci-fi getting covered on the show. One novel in particular that I thought was already very show appropriate is Jules Verne's An Antarctic Mystery. Very much on the weird end of the sci-fi adventure with more than a few parallels to At the Mountains of Madness. I'm sure you've got loads of stories lined up, but thought I'd stick my oar in anyway. We actually don't have a ton of stories lined up yet. We're just starting to work on a schedule. So if you have some Golden Age sci-fi recommendations, send them in.
Yeah, please. We have said that we're going to broaden the scope of what we cover. We know that we're going to cover things that we have been covering because we know you guys like that stuff, horror and fantasy. We like it too. But Golden Age sci-fi, that's a long list. So if anybody has any particulars that they like, please send them in. Episode 592. Thurnley Abbey. On this one, there was a comment on Twitter from a guy, Chris Lackey, that just said, punch that ghost! Gonna assume that was you.
That was me. Professor Koshka writes, I appreciate the vote of confidence, Chad, but I could absolutely not take a ghost in a fight. Mm. Also, I've been listening to the podcast for a while now, and I've been through all the back catalog. I can hear you saying, I love Dean whenever I see the name Dean, and I work at a college, so I see the word Dean with some regularity. But I cannot for the life of me figure out or remember what you're referencing or where it came from and why you love Dean so much. Is it actually from something or another? Did it just spring fully formed from your forehead? Can anyone explain this to me?
You know, sometimes I do feel guilty when we're doing that because I'm not a huge fan of in jokes. I do like things to be obvious for everybody.
Yes.
But so I'm sorry, but it is too delicious to not quote occasionally. Heather and I were having dinner next to Norman Lloyd, the actor, one night in Santa Monica. And it was a little French restaurant where all the tables were crammed and so tight, we might as well have been sitting there with him. And he was sort of holding court with two friends. And we heard the whole conversation. George Orbanks writes, the Dean story is originally from the episode covering The Man from Time by Frank Belknap Long, episode 266, I believe. Yes. So there you go. If you go and tune into that one, I probably give more of a blow by blow on that conversation. But it was really riveting because he passed away a couple of years ago, reportedly, at the age of like 106. Norman Lloyd was around for a very long time and he was friends with Charlie Chaplin. So we got keyed in when he started talking about playing tennis with Charlie Chaplin, which was pretty incredible. And then he and his guests started discussing the romantic life of one of their friends, Dean, and they kept prefacing it with, I love Dean, I love him. But they didn't like his wife so much. By the way, after he passed away, this was also on the show, we did figure out the identity of Dean. It's a television producer, Dean Hargrove. So there's a specific Dean that he did love. The mystery was solved there.
Jim Cannon writes, in addition to all the other things this story does right, it never once tells you what the ghost is, nor whether it is a nun or a monk, though the veil does imply a nun, even though nuns aren't known for wearing veils. It seems more likely a monk. And of course, the house has been a residence for aristocrats for some time, perhaps a bridal veil. Anyway, it does well to be mysterious.
Carlandos writes, the emotional outburst was the thing that stood out to me, obviously. Typically, it always leans into the irrational, paralyzing fear, where you forget how to do basic things. But here we have a dude lose it and thrash the ghost, only to find it going around picking up its pieces. Peter Larson writes, the moral of this story is to punch a ghost in your The moral of all the other ghost stories is don't punch a ghost in your My takeaway, stay the fuck away from ghosts.
Levi Crane writes, I couldn't help but wonder if Nat Painter's vampire story isn't supposed to bring to mind Bram Stoker. There's a similarity with the name syllables and some of the sounds when you compare the names. But why not just say Bram Stoker?
I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe the Bram Stoker estate come after you. You wouldn't be so stoked about that. Matthew Alderman writes, as a heraldry enthusiast and professional heraldic illustrator, no, really, I'm delighted by the heraldry shout out. Also, Dean! That's awesome, Matthew. You know, that's just like with doing the podcast. I still have to explain. I have friends that still send me job recs and stuff, which is great. Mm-hmm. But I go, no, I do this podcast for a living. They're like, yeah, but I just thought you might, you know, you want to see that these people are hiring. Like, no, I really do. I'm sure Matthew's going, no, I am a heraldic illustrator. I really am.
Wadhams writes, when Andrew read the passage, I looked at it and it looked at me and my brains turned dry and hot in my head. I couldn't help thinking the guy should have worn a wig.
I'm glad that you thought that. I hope you think that quite a bit in the future as you're reading things. Grackles writes, the thing is, who's the asshole here? I mean, clearly, the owner of the place is the asshole. But I'd argue so is the protagonist. Mm-hmm. I mean, this ghost has lived here almost forever, right? Mm-hmm. She's been here since medieval times, probably because she died in some horrible catastrophic way for no reason at all except not fitting in somehow. So here she is, still tied to this place completely unfairly, just wandering around with not so much to do. And this guy suddenly shows up. So she goes to have a look and bam, he beats the absolute shit out of her and then runs off with part of her head. She has to schlep all the way over to the new wing to get it back. Is that fair? What did she do to deserve that? Nothing. Even after having a can of booty whip opened on her, she does nothing malevolent. She just quietly picks up her jawbone or whatever it was and goes back to wandering around. I'd say all the corporeal characters in this are complete assholes. That is an awesome reading of the story and probably true. What did the ghost really do?
Yeah.
Other than inspire fear? By the way, found out after we released the show, The Nun 2, sequel to the movie The Nun, which we talked about on the show, was announced right after we released this show.
Whoa.
Just like I Am Legend 2 was announced right after we released our first episode of that show.
All right, yeah.
What's going on here?
We've got the ear of the people, and Hollywood knows that. Bonus episode 42, The Bathtub People of Las Vegas, New Mexico. Ross Clark writes, "Hey Chad, your goodbye to Los Angeles segment at the end of the episode was super poignant for me. I moved to LA about 5 years ago to pursue a creative career, and it always made me smile when a tidbit of LA lore or advice would slip out onto the show. I agree that there have been a lot of changes in the city, even since I moved here, and many for the worse. I would love to hear a bit more of a retrospective on Los Angeles as a bonus episode. Maybe a tour of some of your favorite places in the city now that you aren't at risk of blowing up any of your preferred spots."
We have to go. I heard Chad Pfeiffer's going to be there, said nobody. I love LA. I still like it. I think a little time and space and I'll probably have more to say about it. Right now, it's funny because I like Madison so much and I'm thinking, is that because it's not Los Angeles?
Is this
a rebound? We'll see.
Yeah.
Speaking of moving around, Summer Suzuki writes, "The tiny house rant got me to comment here instead of Twitter. So I'm disabled and have been living with my parents since becoming disabled because I can't really live on my own. This is stressful, to put it nicely. They have land, and we have been looking into tiny houses/container houses to get built on there for me to live in, so I'm not living with them. I was into this idea until this rant, and y'all made me realize that everyone was living in a shipping container in Ready Player One. I gotta get them into looking into something else now." No, you don't, Summer. I think that tiny houses are a perfectly fine alternative. You know, I was just talking about how I felt that those shows were promoting a certain kind of behavior as a way to prime people for that eventual Ready Player One existing in virtual reality only world.
Yes.
But that does not make a small home a bad thing at all.
No, not at all. Especially because that might be the only thing that you can afford. And if that is the only thing you can afford, take it. Don't feel any shame or regret about doing something like that, because that's important. You know, having your own place and having it separate. I could see totally wanting to have, you know, your own little place separate from your parents' house.
Oh my God, you could
just be your own person. So please don't let us...
My old man rant influence you.
Yeah.
I watched those shows, which is part of the reason I even know about it, because I just like the economy of space, you know? That's what hooks you in. Yeah. Oh my God, they turned that table. They just tucked right away. You'd never know it was there. The transformer nature of all of those homes is really fascinating to watch. And also, those exact same networks, maybe it wasn't streaming at the time, but they certainly promoted the McMansion fad that drove us all into financial ruin in 2008. So it went a different direction at one point, where they were like, get your crib, buy a house you can't afford with a dance club in it. Don't pay attention to the terms of that loan. Just get it. And so they built all these huge homes all over this country that are now sitting vacant in weird suburban locales because they were foreclosed on. So this has happened before where the entertainment kind of drives a sort of behavior that might not be the best thing in the world. It's a little more what I was talking about in that context. But
please, Summer, just do what you need to do for you.
Don't listen to us.
Don't listen to us. JP Briskonomicon writes, so that's like a Briscoe County Nomicon. Yeah, that's, I love it.
I do too.
Briskonomicon writes, apologies in advance for the heretical suggestion, Chad, but if you were so inclined, you could now visit August Derlett's old stomping grounds with relative ease. As you might know, he lived in Sauk City, a small town just a 30-minute drive northwest from Madison. At the height of his career, he was a mainstream literary celebrity known among the locals for his regional and historical writings especially. There's a small but not imaginary August Derlett Center. not imaginary. I'm glad he put that up.
Oh, okay.
Open by appointment, and then they give a link to it. You can also drive or walk by the Place of Hawks, Derelict's secluded property on the edge of town, not open to the public, I believe. And finally, the dining room at the nearby Cedarberry Inn has a large wall-mounted display case full of Derelict memorabilia. All very close to the first ever Culver's, so there's also that.
Yeah, well, Culver's is delicious, but I am gonna do all of that. I hope that I don't get in trouble when I enter town because we have said some nasty things about Derelict's Lovecraft pastiches. I think we've always tried to balance that with the measure of gratitude for him establishing Arkham House.
Yes.
And if that hasn't been clear in the past, somebody doesn't have to be a great at a particular type of writing for me to be appreciative of other things they do. And I'm certainly glad that Arkham House got Ray Bradbury into print. And
yes.
And Ramsey Campbell into print and Lovecraft's work after he passed away. So while the practices of co-writing with somebody who's dead are a little suspect, that doesn't mean that you're not good at publishing.
And also kind of snaking away intellectual property that you really had no business having.
Yes, that's right. There's some bad with the good, and there's what I think about it really doesn't matter because I still want to go up there and see the stuff. And also I'd like to see, I know that Arkham House is still run by August Derleth's grandchildren. This is partially why I'm making sure I say this, because I want those books to be in print. And I was thinking about reaching out to them to see, is there anything we can do?
Yeah.
They have the business and you can order books from them, but it feels like, boy, I bet a lot of those would do better if they were priced differently or put in paperback or, you know, what's the library really look like of the anthologies and the collections that they put together? Because they all seem a little cost prohibitive. And I just, hopefully they won't say, why don't you F off? You were talking crap about grandpa. You know, I'd be kind of mad if someone was talking. My grandpa was, both of my grandfathers were assholes.
Sure.
But if somebody was talking about them mean, I'd be like, now, wait a minute. Episode 593, Where Their Fire Is Not Quenched. Brett Kramer writes, I had a real visceral dislike of this story. It was just a couple ha-ha's short of being a chick tract. Fair enough. This one bummed a lot of folks out. In fact, one of the comments on the Thurnley Abbey show at the end was, boy, next week's going to be a bummer. I liked the story a lot, but it's not exactly the fun Robert E. Howard fun fest that we sometimes have.
Yeah, it's not exactly that.
No.
Steve writes, Mason Clare was a member of the Society of Psychical Research and had an interest in spiritualism. Even if she wasn't particularly Christian, perhaps the story is her way of exploring what an agnostic afterlife might be.
Sweating to the Great Oldies writes, I do like a melancholy weird. I didn't get the sense that she was being punished by anything more than her own self-critical mind. I think most folks have had times when we relive our failings, self-flagellation in which we scream or beg or whimper for our own hand to stop the beating. To no avail.
Michelle Albert writes, I had this whole dissertation about how her afterlife could be read as either a Christian hell brought about by choosing not to confess the sin before taking the sacrament and passing, or a personal psychological hell brought about by the unresolved feelings of shame, disappointment, and despair that she settled for a relationship that gave her gratification once, but then was simply a habit she couldn't break even when she recognized her dependence on it and resented that, like drugs or alcohol, but instead an emotionally abusive jerk with whom you're both making each other miserable. But ultimately, all I can say is, good golly, I'm so glad I'm in therapy so I can talk to a professional about all the little ways I identify with this woman.
I'm right there with you, Michelle. I mean, that stuff hits close to home. The cycles of disappointment and depression that you put yourself through, even knowing that there's no reason for you to be doing it. So,
yeah.
Sanjay Matthew writes, I first read this on the old Horror Masters website. I think it may be one of the bleakest stories I've ever read. The biblical allusion in the title is to Mark 9:43. And if thy hand offend thee, cut it off. It is better for thee to enter into life maimed than having two hands to go into hell, into the fire that shall never be quenched, where the worm dieth not and the fire is not quenched. So we've had some references to that specific passage and other fiction that we've read. Sanjay continues, straightforward religious horror aside, I guess it could be read to be about obsessiveness. Yeah, perhaps. Now, we got to get to the end here. We're running out of time, but there's a comment that was left on this episode, which is actually about the fact that we announced Child's Play. That episode's already come out, so I don't mind reading it, and I will forget it on that comments, Joe, so I just wanted to write. Michael Bernth writes, oh boy, I can't wait to hear your take on Child's Play. It was a part of my curriculum in primary school, and it really made an impression.
What?
It was also made into a short animation by Danish director Jannik Hostrup called Just a Prank, but unfortunately, I can't find an online version freely available, so that's called Blot and Drengestreg, if folks can find it. Then he writes, children's entertainment in Denmark can be rather different. Yeah, no kidding.
Oh my God.
That was a part of the primary school curriculum.
Oh my God.
In Denmark. Huh.
Maybe it is a bit of a cautionary tale for children to read.
Oh, you know what? I think it's a great story about critical thinking. Yeah. You know, challenge your own assumptions because you might be really wrong.
Yeah.
It really imparts that lesson in a pretty visceral way. And I guess shows, you know, how good intentions can go so terribly wrong. Or how you and I got into a hard discussion after we talked about that story about trying to figure out if someone's crazy or not. And that's a hard thing to navigate in the world. So
It's a very good story. And obviously we'll talk about it more on the episode, or we did talk about it more on the episode, but we'll talk about your reactions on the next comment show, because this wraps up this comment show.
It does indeed. Thanks everybody for writing in as always. And thank you for your support. We love hearing what you have to say about these things. I'm sure you're going to have a lot more to say about Child's Play. But that's all we have for now. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lankin. You've been listening to The Comet Show exclusively for patrons.
On Patreon.
Craft.com.